Well, I need to start off with a confession. I said this was going to get easier. I lied.
You're just reeling it in.
That name of that song, I told you I loved you, but I lied.
Yeah. Well, but maybe the great archetype in the sky will forgive me, because at the time I believed what I was saying.
We had our doubts. I think
you've
still got one.
You were fooled as well.
I was fooled. Well, just a quick review. We finished up the main part of the text. Now we're starting the scrutinies. And the book ended on a couple of notes. What I'm going to call the imaginative part of the book. This is more the reflections on the imaginative part, at least for a while. This business of love, life, and flesh, that he's realizing how important it is to honor his desires of the flesh, and that as the starting point for any growth. Clearly wrestling with, at least in my mind, his attraction to Toni Wolff. And that really does form a key aspect of his psychology, that this work starts with desire. Body desire with emotions, and then we go from there.
But that, are we in the scrutinies now?
No, I'm just summarizing what we what we've done up to the scrutinies. Then you have the fairy tale where a king is born, killed, reborn, suggesting to me that the struggle to accept what he's just realized, and that's a lot of what the scrutinies are. It's the attempt now to struggle with accepting everything we've just heard in the main part of the book. The importance of being childlike and like a pregnant woman is stressed there at the end, meaning that his idea of traditional masculinity, of conquer, you know, utilize willpower, is being called into question. And then we began the scrutinies in which he proceeds to beat himself up. And we went over to the second column about the middle of 333. There's no page on that one, but it's where the scrutinies start. That is not untypical, that you get the revelation and then the monsters start attacking. That is very typical. Why? It's like you have seen the beauty of what you can achieve, and you feel you'll never be able to do it. That's one way. So that you feel stupid, you feel, you know, this will never work out. What was the point of all that work beforehand? Life's conspired against me before. It's going to conspire against me now. Nothing is good's going to come of it. That is very typical. On the other hand, the attack can somewhat be based in, oh, look how poor I am vis-a-vis what I can be. And, you know, I'm really a piece of shit. And here is what I could be, but look at what I am. I am nothing, and so on. So, not untypical. The way I frame it to myself, you know, in the initiation, you've got the child with the parents. You've got the child as, well, the young initiate as adult. And that in between is what anthropologists call the betwixt in between. You're not a child anymore. You're not an adult yet. That's the most dangerous period of any analytic work and any process of transformation. And I think that's what we're seeing, just how thoughts can derail that process.
We're at the beginning of scrutiny?
Yeah, yeah. He just, you know, you're nothing, you're vain, you're never going to amount to anything. These are the thoughts that are going through his head. And two things he has done. Within short order, he has resigned from the university. He had a teaching position there. And he has resigned from the presidency of the Psychoanalytic Society. So, as we were mentioning last week, I imagine he's saying things to himself like, am I just a loser? You know, I have this path in front of me. I could be a big psychoanalyst. I could be a big professor. Why can't I just enjoy what I have? Well, we know in retrospect, because there was another birth coming, but, you know, losers do the same thing. They have everything right there in front of themselves, and they piss it away for something irrelevant. And I'm sure those thoughts were, or that motivation was behind some of these thoughts.
You know, I was reading, it may have been the Jung Freud lovers, but there was a section in it where it said that he felt, for his own integrity, he couldn't keep saying what he was saying in those classes.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's the healthy side. But these demons, they just come in and tear you apart when you've left the old behind before the new has been realized, and you really don't know if you couldn't enjoy what you had simply because you can't enjoy anything. And I think that was what was going through his mind. Now, once you've reached the new shore, things change. But in that betwixt and between,
I find this really hard to read. I only read about one page because so much of this crap is the kind of crap that I am fighting.
So when we get to the footnote, it says that he's writing this off in a sense as a confrontation with the shadow. Is that he just trying to put a good face on it? What's the shadow here? The demons at work, or the things that he is describing in himself?
Well, that's a good question. I want to answer that on a couple of levels. I think we got to be careful about throwing labels on voices. And I would just prefer to say it's a voice in him that he has to come to terms with.
Which
the critical thoughts.
Okay.
He calls it the shadow. Well, it might be. It sounds to me like the anima sometimes. The self can say those things. Given that he really didn't have a full grasp of the psyche at this point, that's where I would just go and say there's a voice that is attacking him. Now, the deeper part of your question, what do you do about it? Two things. You have to accept part of it and reject part of it.
Seems to me like pretty much everything he said is true of everybody.
Yeah. It's true of everybody, and but to what degree and how long? See, it would be, it's what these voices say, you never pay attention to the deeper meaning of a conversation, something like that. It would be more accurate to say, sometimes you miss part of it. So you have to go back to the voices and recast what they say in words like sometimes and to some degree, and it's part of the human condition that. That's the art of working with it. Which I think he then did throughout his life. There's two dangers. One, that you listen to them and you're demoralized and you jump off a bridge. Although there is a grain of truth to them, so the other danger is you don't hear anything and you miss the feedback that's coming through that voice. But it's a precarious process. Those of us who did the Nietzsche will appreciate the methodology, which really I learned from doing a series of the Nietzsche books. Nietzsche's like that all the time. I mean, his sentences are just like, bleh! And half of them are just sick. Half of them are profound insights. Sometimes there are generalizations which are true only in specific moments and so on. And what Jung did in that book was go through each freaking sentence, sometimes in the same sentence there were contradictions, and lift out what was valid, lift out the way in which it could be understood as valid, and what needed to be rejected. That's the ego confronting the unconscious.
Unfortunately, Nietzsche was so alone, he had no one.
Had no one to do that.
Could do that with him.
Yeah.
Plus, he said he was born handicapped, probably, we're not sure.
You know, I discussed that with actually a pathologist, and oh, it's so complicated how they do a differential diagnosis, but he thought not.
Okay.
He said if he had, I forget the reasons he gave me, I think it would have struck him earlier. Something like that.
And that 12-year period when he was sort of comatose,
yeah,
wouldn't have happened, I
right.
think. I read with the tertiary.
Yeah. Problems. And the confusing detail is some of the symptoms in childhood do sound syphilitic. You know, violent headaches, compulsive vomiting. But this guy said he didn't think so.
It's probably another congenital...
Or just being raised in a crazy family.
Yeah.
I mean, back then you had lead poisoning, you had all
yeah.
kinds of strange things that as well.
Plus, he was having sex with his sister.
And anorexic.
What? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anorexic, probably.
Is that back
then?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he got the support.
Yeah,
she lived longer than he did.
So. That's a good scapegoat.
Blame it on the woman.
Oh, I'd love to pin that on her.
And his dad died of syphilis.
I know that.
And was a minister.
And was a minister.
Sweet.
Yeah. Anyway,
he's messed up.
He had some problems.
Where's that document?
His sister's biography has been published, and she wrote it. And for years, I guess, this is what Edinger said, that Nietzsche scholarship has tried to keep that book out of the press, but it's been published, and in which she announces.
But she also took care of him at the end of his life. For all those years.
So there is some reason for there being crazy families in the world. They have to all funnel into the person who's finally going to do something with the crazy.
But just the way Jung worked with seeing the beauty in that craziness, the truth in it, mm-hmm. and then how the truth is only really true if you reinterpret it, and then rejecting. That's the secret.
Right, so much of what was coming through him was all archetypal stuff.
Yeah.
And he got infected by that, so there was no way to insist on his humanity in that situation.
Are you talking about Jung now?
No, I'm talking about Nietzsche. I think Jung kind of, he kept connected to life through his family, his
yes,
children,
yes.
his wife, his patients, he was still very connected to a community of people,
yeah.
probably the other people who were studying, you
yeah.
know, under him. Nietzsche had no one.
Yeah, it's very
absolutely
important.
No
good
one.
Friends are really important.
Mm-hmm. He chased everybody away because
mm-hmm.
he was just so disagreeable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so we got then the second column on 333. Now, again, Jung says this is the shadow speaking. I hate to disagree with that, but I would prefer to say it's a voice, which is a conglomeration of many archetypal factors. And the shadow says now, for I want to get along with you. I must, damn you. You are my I. Now, that's typical self-talk, that the self needs the I. So that would suggest that the weight of everything he's learning is seeking to be realized by his conscious personality. Then they get into the death of God. Couple lines down. And you know, don't expect this to be linear thinking. We've gone from the role of the ego and the self to back to sexuality again, back to the instincts in the body. That the old God is dead, but the God that remains is the snake. The snake, which would represent the passions of the body, guiding us, if we know how to accept them, towards consciousness. That's the new God. And there's that reference to the earlier image, remember, where the snake coils around Salome? Coil yourself and sweat blood. You have needed this cure for a long time. In the middle of the big paragraph on the second half of the second column. I'm just touching the main points because he does kind of go on a little bit. Then all of a sudden, he's being chided not to be self-righteous. Yes, others always do wrong, but and you? And then the last line of that paragraph goes back to the Eros issue again. Have you not noticed that your God has become a fiery worm, so the passions of the body, with a flat skull who crawls red hot on the earth?
If only he had painted that. I'd like to see that.
Uh-huh.
A flat skull. Why?
Well, doesn't a snake have a...
Yeah, like a cobra especially.
Yeah.
Yeah, they all have pretty flat skulls. So just a typical snake head.
Yeah. It's just, you know...
Like a tapeworm. I was too. A worm.
They're pretty flat.
They're flat.
Yeah, they are.
And their blood
sucks.
They get
weird. They take the life out of you, yeah. No nutrients given to you, yeah. He had a tapeworm in the images a while. Somewhere.
You want to be superior. How laughable. You were and are inferior. You see, that's that voice that just wants you to kill yourself. Who are you then, scum that disgusts me? And that's where you'd have to say, no, I'm not scum. If I'm scum, why are you even bothering talking to me?
And why did I have all of the experience I just had?
Why would you have given me all that experience if I'm so worthless?
Mm-hmm.
So you got to just talk back to these voices. Sometimes listen, sometimes reinterpret, sometimes talk back.
But Jung doesn't talk back, at least here.
No.
Because he seems to feel he has to explore this.
Yeah. I think the way I work with it is I write this stuff down. Mm-hmm. And I don't touch it for a week. Because you got to get out of that state of mind. Mm-hmm. Then you go back to it in a fresh state of mind and begin picking it up.
He wrote it down.
Yeah.
Came back to it later.
Yeah, another just... plain belittlement. Your progress since the early Middle Ages appears to be minuscule. Yeah, he's just saying, you know, everything is crap. You're crap, everything's crap. Whole world's crap. And I don't think anyone who goes through this process is spared these attacks. I don't know how he says, ironically said or not, did you feel dejected today? Inferior, debased? Shall I tell you why? But these voices too particularly attack when you've left a previous way of living. A previous relationship or a previous job or a previous belief system or a previous group of friends, the voices don't say congratulations for letting the old go, I'll help you move on to the new. The voices tell you how terrible you are because life isn't working.
And they're not just inside yourself. You just run into people who will be glad to take you down if you knock.
Absolutely.
So it's within and without, and whether that's just, you know, a projection of what's going on inside of you or...
I think it... You know, in this period, you do look wounded. and people will pick on you. Mm-hmm. That's a big reason to keep your mouth shut about what's going on in your inner process. As you get stronger, maybe, but I think it's very important to be careful. Now, again, the next one on 334, there's a grain of truth to it. There was no truth in these other statements, these last two, that, you know, you're useless, you're scum, but your inordinate ambition is boundless. I think that is something Jung had to face.
So in that spot, he must confront shadow, probably.
Yeah.
So it's a real mix there, confronting aspects of the ego, split-off aspects, the wisdom of the self, shadow, it's all
and the term Jung used for this, he drew from alchemy, is the mass of confusion. It's just a big confused mass. And I think this first paragraph on 334 is first of all something for all of us, and really driving home something we've seen throughout this whole series, starting with the death of Siegfried, the difference between ego and self. Your grounds are not focused on the good of the matter, but on your vanity. In other words, that you do something for the recognition you get, not for the quiet satisfaction of knowing you've made a valuable contribution. So the emphasis is on you, not on what is done. But it's a very fine line. You do not work for humanity, but for your self-interest. I think that's something we have to constantly ask ourselves, and certainly something Jung had to deal with in himself. Now, it's interesting, you know, you've heard me gripe about this book by Deirdre Baer. That's what she accuses Jung of all the time. Everything he does, she says, is for his own ambition. And in a way, it looks similar when you serve the self or you serve the ego. Because when you serve the self, meaning that you have discovered your gift to the world, you will fight for it. And if you have to run over people sometimes who are trying to stop you, you will run over them. And it can look like egotism. But the difference, I think, of, let's say, what an egotist would have done with Jungian psychology and what Jung did with Jungian psychology is, at those points where speaking his truth cost him personally, he didn't stop his truth. That's the difference. Where an egotist would bend the message to the audience. And if you're serving the self, you do speak in a strong voice and in a way push yourself forward, that what you're pushing is your gift, not your need for recognition. I think that's the distinction, which he is getting clear in this period. You do not strive for the completion of the thing, but for the general recognition and safeguarding of your own advantage. And it's a very fine line whether when you are passionately engaged in something, it's done for your ego's reasons or for the existence of that thing that you are communicating to the world.
And yet it does take a certain amount of ego to even be able to do it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But the ego is harnessed to the self.
Right.
Absolutely, yeah. But what that might be experienced like from other people might look like egotism.
It might look like ambition. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Certainly.
Did Deirdre Baer ever meet Jung?
No.
had a, this popped into my mind. Years ago, when I used to go to gay bars, somebody was running for mayor as a Democrat, and he came to the gay bars and he was handing out flyers or whatever. I don't know what he was doing, but he was trying to get the gay vote, which I appreciated intellectually, but I had a huge negative reaction to him. And I thought, you know, one of the problems with this is that ambition, intellectually, you can look at things, but you can't intuitively sense people on television and stuff. But if you are in a room with them, you can intuitively sense whether they are hooked up with a selfer, whether they're ambitious. I don't know why I felt the need for that.
Well, yeah, I think it's hard to find a politician who's not ego motivated.
Yeah. Why would you get into that?
Why would you get into it in the first place?
Yeah, you don't get paid that much. It's not like you're going to get rich being a politician.
Okay, so more criticism. Next paragraph about. His being accused of sort of being a silver-tongued fellow. And part of that might be true at this point. I don't think that's all true. And again, I would go back to the voice, sometimes, somewhat, because Jung has also started to make very big sacrifices here. Left the university, left the psychoanalytic world, and so on.
And yet, without his eloquence, how could he possibly get his message across? He could just blurt it all out like Nietzsche did, and no one wanted to read it.
Right.
Yeah, or hear it.
Good,
that,
good.
That eloquence served him.
That's how you got to speak back.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, these voices just cripple you. You're gloating and resentful. You know, I would go, sometimes, give me an example, and so on. And that continues for quite a while. Basically, he's being accused of being an egotist on that first line.
I suppose when a voice gives this information, it's even more valuable not to apply it to history, but to apply it as you go forward. So you think about those words as you go forward.
Right. Yeah. All of that, that's a really good point, Carol. All of these considerations must enter in. And if it said to me, you are shameless in everything where no one sees you. Now I would say, then wait a minute, what do you mean everything?
No, I'd have to look at my behavior as I did something.
Or give
like
me an example. Mm-hmm. If you're so damn concerned that I'm a complete loser, how about one example? And you'd be surprised. The voices often just shut up. Because there isn't an example.
It also sounds like a negative mother.
Yeah.
Through here too.
Yeah. That's the negative feminine.
Negative.
But rooted in the negative mother complex.
Did he even have a negative mother complex, did he?
Well, he had a positive mother complex. Yeah. But in a man with a positive mother complex, the compensatory reaction is a negative animal can be. Because the world is always supposed to, you know, fall in your lap, mm-hmm. and when it doesn't, then it just gets sour.
Mm.
Have you bettered yourself? I would say yes. From where do you get the right to have opinions of others? Well, why shouldn't I? And so on. I think you get the point. Do not speak to me about your love. The last. What you call love oozes with self-interest and desirousness. Now, I would say, you have just spoken to me in 300 freaking pages about desirousness. So shut up. Self-interest, okay, I'll look at that. And I think, you know, the only way you can check that is, do I tailor my message to the audience, or do I keep speaking my truth regardless of the reaction?
But again, as Kathy said, to tailor things to an audience.
Mm-hmm. The form, not the content.
The form, not the content, yes. I will agree with that.
And, you know, he may not have been clear on that yet. He really did work very hard tailoring the form to the audience.
Until after the heart attack.
I think until after the heart attack.
And then he thought, what do I have to lose?
Yeah, I could be dead. Might as well just tell him. Mm-hmm. They haven't listened anyway.
But at first, I think, you know, that whole don't cast your pearls before swine, I think you do have to be rather careful when you're in the betwixt and the between.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm glad you said that part about the young person when they are in that Ophelia stage where they're not, you know, a child anymore, but they're not an adult either. It's just such that I think that we go through that all through our lives when we come through transitions, different stages that we go on.
It's a cycle. It is. You go through this again and again. I think you kind of learn how it works.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you can kind of say, well, here it comes. I better withdraw and work on it.
Yeah.
But, yeah. That's why so many people end up boring old people in old age.
You almost have to come to expect it if you're going through a transition.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like when you have children. The first time through, especially me, I would get hurt by every little pulling away. And then the second time through, it's like, oh, well, that's what that is.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you can sit back and, you know, watch and not take it so personally.
Right. But it applies to your work as well.
So boring old people in old age is because you don't continue to go through transitions.
That's because that negative period is just very unpleasant.
You either get stuck in cynicalness, or you get stuck in naive. Mm-hmm. Not mm-hmm. places. Mm-hmm. You think you've arrived. This is it. I know people who just retire in the mid-50s, and that's it. They're mm-hmm. not any different than when they were then.
Yeah.
The rest of their lives. But that's, I know.
Time for a cruise.
$80,000 camper and trying to
herd
it down the road.
Hey, at least that's an adventure.
Ask this question. You said Erickson's eighth stage is generativity versus stagnation.
Yeah.
I'm trying to say thank you. I was just thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what he's preparing himself for, if you look at it from Erickson's point of view. Yeah. More, you're proud. You know, it's just the same thing in different words. Top, second column, top of 334. An interesting statement straight out of Nietzsche. You should make a virtue out of your self-contempt.
Where's that?
First, second, third, fourth, fifth paragraph, second column.
Yeah, that whole talk on virtue throughout this made me think of Nietzsche.
You know, there again, this is a double-edged sword. What we've got up to now is all self-contempt. And there is a partial truth in it. That's why we can't dismiss it. It's also partial lies in it, which is why we can't totally accept it. But to wish for a clear, happy consciousness would be against continuing to grow. Because these negative thoughts aren't always wrong. And we have to be able to hear our own criticism of ourself to continue growing.
Is that an actual quote from Nietzsche, or is that just Nietzsche?
It's pretty darn close if it's not a direct quote.
His voice could be dishing up Nietzsche to him. To
yeah.
More, probably unconsciously.
Probably. I think he had read him once, I think, by this point. Now, that next paragraph, the taming begins with you. Not a bad idea. You know that story that Gandhi tells, that I think a mother came to him and said, my son has a terrible diet, he keeps eating sugar. And Gandhi said, would you talk to him? And he said, well, come back in a couple of weeks and we'll talk about it. So the mother came back and said, well, I'm back to discuss, you know, if you would talk to my son about his eating habits. And Gandhi said, okay, I will. And the mother said, well, why did you take 3 weeks to decide? He said, I had to stop eating sugar myself first. See, that we shouldn't expect others, particularly as a therapist, to undertake steps that we are not taking ourselves. So, see, that's a very valid truth.
At the end of that paragraph, I guess I need some more explanation about your sensitivity as your particular form of violence.
Let's see, where is that?
That same paragraph.
The rest of the paragraph.
Yeah, okay. I must whip you. See, that's too much. You don't have to whip me. Just tell me. I think what they're, again, what the voice is saying, we have to be careful about accepting. But I think it's saying, if you don't allow, if you're too sensitive to allow negative thoughts to come in, then you don't give yourself feedback. And if you don't give yourself feedback, you end up hurting other people. I think it's something like that. But again, it's spoken in too broad a stroke, in always a half-empty way. The voice could have said, don't be afraid of criticism because it will help you grow and be a better friend to others. But it puts it in a half-empty way. You are worthless because you can't hear me. Your soul is with the fiery God. Now, we'll pick up on that later, and coming up pretty soon.
The last
sentence on that first set of paragraphs, the second column.
Oh, your soul through. Is with the fiery God.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. You know, but you are an idiot. That's just a little too broad. But that's the negative voice at work.
But then he goes on to say, you cannot take revenge on fate. And I don't think we can take revenge on fate. I think we have a fate, and then we have to do something positive with that. And that's not revenge. If you're living from revenge, the thing has got you. That's what I'm
saying. Let's see. Let me hang on here. I noticed you are forging secret plans for revenge, plotting deceitful tricks, but you are an idiot. You cannot take revenge on fate. Yeah, I think it would depend on what we mean by fate. If you are the child of an alcoholic whose dad, whose grandfather was an alcoholic, your fate may be, in the negative sense, pushing you toward a destructive life. And I think that you have the right to rail against.
Okay.
This is just, as I have tried to understand it, it's very, my vocabulary is very subjective. But I think we could distinguish between fate and destiny. Fate would be when you've been given a family pattern that's destructive that unawares you could repeat. You know, addictive behavior, failing behaviors, low self-esteem. People experience that as a force coming from outside themselves. And there, I think, we do need sufficient rage against the destructiveness to keep from repeating it. Now, I don't know what he means by fate here. If it's destiny, right. It's you can't fight it. If it's what I'm calling fate, I think you need to fight it. The problem is they feel exactly the same.
Right. If it was his destiny to do what he did, create Jungian psychology, yeah, to take revenge on that, yeah, he would die.
He would die, yeah.
But the whole idea of then building bridges, to me, seemed like a positive way to build a bridge to that destiny.
Yes.
Is a much better way to squander your energy.
Yeah.
Not even squandered.
Well, he uses that phrase later. I like that. Yeah.
To invest your energy, yeah, than, you know, to constantly be filled with anger and rageful revenge against this thing that you were born to do.
Yeah, yeah. It all depends. But the thing you've got to remember is how close those two feel when you're confronting them. Okay. But yeah, your point's well taken. Pardon?
And so was yours.
Oh, okay. You want to be understood. Now, here's another one. That's all we needed. Understand yourself, and you will be sufficiently understood. You will have quite enough work in hand with that. Mother's little dears want to be understood. Understand yourself. That is the best protection against sensitivity and satisfies your childish longing to be understood. Now, that is not human. We all need to be understood. And I don't know if you remember in the Gripcruiser material, those of you who are doing it, she talks about how the anima wants its imagery communicated to the world. So that's just too simple. There is a sense where being an adult means putting up with misunderstanding. That is true. There's also a sense that we have to strive to communicate our message, and that message itself wants to be understood. We aren't childish for seeking to finish that process. So again, a statement that is partially true and partially not true. Well, then he says there at the end, he wrote in 1934 that this was a confrontation with the shadow. And that, as he says in point number two there at the bottom, as I could deal with these thoughts, it was easier to be with myself. I think one reason people are so busy is they can't be still. And the reason they can't be still is, as soon as they are, they have hateful thoughts about themselves. That is behind our frenetic culture.
It would be the whole gamut of deserved and undeserved hateful thoughts.
Right. Right. Exactly.
And if I look at this correctly, then that goes back to the fate and destiny thing, where fate is you're looking backward into your what's happening, your destructive family patterns, let's say. But destiny is looking forward.
Yeah.
And something that you can figure out to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an interesting point for me, because I constantly got a mixed up.
It's very difficult. I think to remember he's just resigned from two pretty plum positions. Now, you know, I'm sure you know people who come up to something good in life and sabotage it. Mm-hmm. And so he's in essence asking himself, am I going through this because I am sabotaging what is good? Can I simply not enjoy my own success. What, in later views, he would see as destiny is moving him through that to another place in life, but he doesn't know that at the time, yet. I mean, he knows it maybe mentally, but he hasn't really, Jungian psychology hasn't been born yet.
So is there always a conflict? I'm not going to say always. Is there a conflict sometimes between fate and destiny, and that fate is like the death energy and it's trying to pull you back into,
yeah,
where destiny is the future pulling you,
yeah,
you into.
I think you could use always.
And then there's the battle between, mm-hmm, those two in our lives. And we go through that over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. I bet, you know, we talked about loving good singers. If you talk to them, they would say the same thing. I've struggled to stay true and to my talent and believe in myself. I bet you wouldn't find no one who says, oh, yeah.
I've always believed it,
yeah.
Usually those are the mediocre singers.
Those are the mediocre singers. Because, see, this, in a way, you could say these negative thoughts are the voice of conscience. You're not living up to yourself.
Right. And the whole thing about singing is finding the true voice. And that takes going inside yourself.
And ironically, if you know how to work with these negative voices, they will lead you to your true voice. It's terribly confusing, mm-hmm, and dangerous. Should we have a stretch?